Imagine trying to solve one of computer science's most famous impossible puzzles.
Oh, you mean the ones that are literally mathematically proven to be unsolvable?
Exactly. A puzzle that Alan Turing himself proved could never be solved using pure logic. But imagine you just, bypass that impossibility entirely.
Right. Not by finding better logic, but by taking computer code and actually treating it like a physical object.
Yeah, like a piece of geometry that you can measure in real time, in the real world.
And moving from abstract logic to physical geometry, well, it changes the entire landscape of what's possible in computing.
Right, because you stop asking what the code thinks it's doing and you start observing how it physically behaves.
Exactly.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to unpack a really fascinating, honestly, kind of massive stack of notes we've received on something called superintelligence field programming via AI.
And the premise we're exploring here is, well, it's entirely counterintuitive.
Yeah, if you are sitting there thinking, oh, this is about feeding an AI all the right answers to make it smarter, we are looking at the exact opposite.
Completely the opposite.
This is a system where AI networks achieve like intense innovation, not by getting answers, but by being injected with exactly 32 high-stakes, highly specific questions.
And what we really need to establish right out of the gate for the listener is that this isn't just some quirky new way to write software.
Right.
It is a system-agnostic framework. The mathematics driving this is something called conditional collapse theory. It changes how we view problem solving.
And how organizations function, right?
Yeah, and ultimately how we even define intelligence itself.
So let's tackle that, the conditional collapse theory, or CCT. The source material states that to understand this superintelligence field, we actually have to throw out our standard definition of intelligence.
Which is usually just, knowing the right answer.
Right. But CCT defines it as paying physical work or energy to expand theories into probability tokens.
I know that's a really dense definition, but we can break it down. Think about what a computer is actually doing on your desk.
It's using power.
Exactly. It's consuming real-world energy, electricity, compute cycles to perform work. Under CCT, intelligence is the process of spending that energy to buy certainty.
To buy certainty. I like that.
Yeah, when you face an ambiguous problem, you have this massive cloud of theories. By spending compute energy, you test those theories and convert them into probability tokens.
Probability tokens, which are essentially just verified facts, right? Data points that you now hold with absolute confidence.
Spot on. You're spending energy to buy little slices of certainty.
And the core rule of this exchange, the source says it comes from computational complexity, specifically the P versus NP problem.
Right, which, to put it simply, means verifying a solution is incredibly cheap, but finding a solution from scratch is astronomically expensive.
Therefore, questions are cheaper than answers.
Exactly. Questions are cheaper.
Like if I ask you, is 73 times 42 equal to 3066? You can verify that almost instantly.
Right, they just do the math quickly.
But if I just look at you and say, hey, what two numbers multiply to 3066?
Oh, man. I'd have to spend a lot more energy searching for that answer.
Right. So applying this to AI, if I just point a single AI agent at a million lines of code and say, fix the bugs, I am asking it to find the answer from scratch.
The energy requirement for that is just too vague and massive.
Exactly. Which is why this framework introduces the question injection protocol, or QIP.
Right, QIP. Instead of asking for an answer, you use a separate, highly specialized AI called the injector.
And the injector's sole purpose is just to look at the system and generate specific questions. The notes call this injected entropy.
Right, injected entropy.
Let me try to visualize this injected entropy for the listener. Imagine you run a massive detective agency, right? And you have 50 detectives sitting around in a bullpen.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you walk into the room and just yell, hey, solve crime in this city.
Nobody knows where to start.
Exactly. The directive is way too broad. But if you inject entropy into that room by pinning 32 highly specific bounties to the wall.
Ah, like where was the red sedan parked at midnight on Tuesday?
Yes. Or who holds the key to the downtown warehouse? Suddenly, the whole network of detectives buzzes into action. They have precise targets.
That detective agency analogy really highlights a crucial mechanism here, which the source calls collapse potential.
Collapse potential, yeah.
Let's say one of your detectives finds the red sedan and discovers it was rented by the owner of the downtown warehouse.
Oh, wow.
They didn't just answer their one specific question. That answer violently alters the entire investigation. It immediately eliminates 90% of the suspects in the city.
Which means the search space for...
For all the other detectives working on the remaining questions just collapsed.
The answers are all interconnected. Finding one piece of the puzzle instantly makes the surrounding pieces obvious.
Exactly. In the context of a software code base, when a question with high collapse potential is answered by one of the AI agents in the swarm, the ambiguity of the entire system shrinks.
So the work of every other AI agent suddenly requires less compute energy.
Precisely.
Okay, so if I'm an engineer listening to this, or really anyone trying to solve a complex problem, I'm probably wondering about the nature of these questions.
Yeah.
Like, if I have an advanced AI, why do I need a rigid system of exactly 32 questions? Usually I just paste my code into a prompt and ask, hey, what's the most urgent technical debt here? Why doesn't that work?
The text actually explicitly warns against that approach. Generic questions produce generic answers.
Oh, okay.
If you ask an AI to find technical debt, it's going to return a high-level philosophical summary of best practices.
Right. It'll just say, oh, your architecture's tightly coupled.
Yeah, and you can't execute a philosophical summary. To force a conditional collapse, the question injection protocol relies on code-specific locality.
Meaning the question has to point to literal physical coordinates in the code.
Exactly. The injector AI achieves this by parsing the abstract syntax tree, or AST, of the code base.
And an AST is basically a structural map of the code, right?
Think of it like diagramming a sentence in grammar school, where you identify the noun, the verb, and how they connect. The injector uses this map to find exact elements.
So it won't ask what assumptions are invalidated.
No, it will ask, what assumption does the function fetch user data make about the Redis database cluster on line 402 that is never validated?
Wow, that is incredibly specific. You are giving the AI swarm GPS coordinates to investigate, not just a vague picture of a mountain.
And the injector generates these GPS coordinates by systematically moving through four distinct layers of inquiry.
Okay, four layers. Let's walk through those. It starts with the foundation, right? The stationary structure.
Right, so this would be the fixed rules of the universe the code lives in. The injector is looking for invariant laws or a single source of truth.
Like asking what dependencies are absolutely hard-coded into the module.
Exactly. Once the stationary foundation is mapped, the code base cannot just sit there. It has to execute.
So this brings the injector to layer two, the probability and behavior layer.
Because when real-world data hits those fixed rules, things get messy.
Right. Users do weird things.
Yeah. So the AI begins hunting for edge cases by asking which specific inputs cause the most chaotic branching or where race conditions might occur when two functions try to access the same data simultaneously.
Okay, so you map the rigid structure, then you map the chaotic execution. I assume the third layer is where we start trying to actually fix things.
Yes, that is the conditional collapse layer. It involves highly strategic pathfinding.
Pathfinding? How so?
The injector asks questions designed to trigger massive downstream effects. For instance, which single bug fix in the authentication module would eliminate the highest number of downstream errors in the user dashboard?
Oh, wow. It is searching for the keystone to pull out of the arch. But, you know, code doesn't just exist in the present moment. If you build a pristine piece of software, give it a year of updates, new features, and quick patches, it starts to rot.
Technical decay is inevitable.
So how does the injector account for the future?
That's the final layer. It addresses time and evolution through ODE-CCT dynamics.
ODE stands for ordinary differential equations, right?
Yeah.
Differential equations, so we are tracking rates of change over time.
Software architecture decays at measurable rates. A database query that takes 10 milliseconds today might take 12 milliseconds next month as the data grows.
Right, it gets slower.
And ordinary differential equations allow the AI to track those subtle rates of change. The injector asks questions like, how does this specific caching function drift from its original architectural intent over time?
Or like, are there limit cycles emerging where a process is slowly beginning to endlessly thrash between two states?
Precisely.
Okay, so we have 32 questions drawn from these four layers, ranging from hard-coded structure all the way up to differential equations predicting future decay.
Right.
And we throw a swarm of AI workers at these questions. But how do they actually collaborate without stepping all over each other? I mean, if I put 50 AIs in a code base, I feel like they would just overwrite each other's work and create total chaos.
The network topology actually prevents that chaos through the same code-specific locality we just discussed. The swarm assignment is heavily partitioned.
Heavily partitioned.
Yes. Worker A might be assigned exclusively to the questions regarding the fetch user data function, while Worker B is restricted entirely to the Redis database calls.
Oh, okay. So they are completely siloed in their execution.
In execution, yes, but not in knowledge. They communicate through a shared memory space called the collapse board.
The collapse board?
Whenever an AI worker discovers a partial answer or verifies a probability token, it posts it to this central board. This triggers the magic of conditional chaining.
Okay, let's walk through a conditional chain for the listener. Say worker A is investigating question 3 and discovers that the configuration parser explicitly assumes all incoming data will be encoded in UTF-8. So worker A posts that strict assumption to the collapse board.
Right, and instantly, worker C, who is across the system investigating question 12 about why certain user inputs are triggering random crashes, sees that new probability token.
And their context completely shifts.
Exactly. Worker C's context fundamentally shifts.
Yeah.
They realize the crashes aren't random memory leaks. They are happening because non-UTF-8 inputs are slamming into that unvalidated assumption worker A just uncovered.
It's sort of like a massive, you know, interconnected game of Sudoku.
That's a great way to look at it.
You stare at the grid initially, and it looks impossible because there are too many blank squares. The ambiguity is just too high.
Right.
But the moment you confidently write the number 7 into one square, which is analogous to answering one of our 32 questions, you immediately eliminate possibilities for the squares in that entire row and column.
Exactly.
You didn't directly touch the other squares, but you collapse their search space. One action triggers a cascading geometric collapse of the puzzle.
That Sudoku visualization is the exact mathematical geometry occurring on the collapse board. The process is super additive.
This is super additive.
Yeah. The collective intelligence of the AI swarm becomes substantially greater than the sum of its parts. Through this conditional chaining, the system organically uncovers emergent behaviors.
Like what kind of behaviors?
Well, it begins spontaneously refactoring code and predicting structural bugs before they even manifest, which is something no single AI could achieve sequentially.
I'm following the Sudoku logic, but every Sudoku puzzle eventually ends. What happens when the swarm answers 31 of the questions? The search space has collapsed, the bugs are found. Do they just pack up and go home?
This is where the framework becomes an infinite engine. The 32nd question is a recursive trigger.
A recursive trigger.
Yeah. Question 32 is always the same fundamental prompt. After answering the previous 31 questions and observing the current state of the system, what single function or line of code remains the highest entropy?
So out of everything left, what is the most ambiguous, problematic piece of code remaining?
Exactly. And once the swarm identifies that single highest entropy function, the system feeds that specific coordinate back to the injector AI.
Oh, wow.
The injector then generates a brand new set of 32 targeted questions exclusively for that one problematic function.
It just drills down. It's a self-sustaining innovation loop that constantly targets the weakest link, forces a collapse, finds the next weakest link, and repeats.
It continually drives the system's entropy lower and lower, perpetually refining the structure.
Okay, so we've spent this entire deep dive looking at how this framework uses the geometry of collapsing uncertainty to fix code.
Right.
But here is where the source material takes a stunning leap. It takes this exact same mathematical concept of conditional collapse and applies it not to writing code, but to running code.
And by doing so, it offers a real-world solution to the unsolvable. The halting problem.
Which is wild. This is the moment the framework bridges software engineering and statistical physics.
It really is. For the listener to fully grasp the weight of this, we need to frame the halting problem clearly.
Go for it.
It asks a deceptively simple question. If you were given a computer program and its input, can you logically determine if the program will eventually finish running and halt, or if it will get stuck in an infinite loop and run forever?
Right. And in 1936, Alan Turing published a foundational proof stating that a general algorithm to solve the halting problem for all possible programs cannot exist.
Right. It is logically undecidable.
You cannot use pure logic to prove what another piece of logic will do indefinitely without just, well, running it.
Turing demonstrated that because of inherent issues with self-reference programs analyzing themselves, logic alone hits a wall.
But the source documents bypass this logical roadblock entirely by introducing the central limit theorem, or CLT.
Yes, the central limit theorem.
If you've taken a statistics class, you probably know this as the principle that averages tend to converge into a Gaussian distribution, a bell curve.
The radical insight here is to stop treating a running computer program as purely abstract mathematical logic. Instead, you treat its execution as a stochastic process, a statistical process evolving over time. As a program runs on physical hardware, it generates physical metrics.
Like what?
It allocates memory, it consumes CPU cycles, the stack depth fluctuates, error rates spike and drop.
It's leaving a physical footprint.
Exactly. If you track those physical metrics over time, the central limit theorem dictates that their variance will converge into an observable geometric shape.
Oh, wow.
Instead of trying to use logic to deduce if the code will eventually stop, you simply observe the geometric shape of its physical metrics as it runs. The framework states, we are looking for a variance signature.
A variance signature. So the variance of that bell curve reveals the program's destiny.
Right.
Let me try a physical analogy for these signatures, because treating software like a physical object is a little wild. Imagine you are watching a spinning top on a table.
Okay, I'm with you.
The top has a slight wobble to it as it spins. Let's call that wobble the variance.
The framework outlines three specific variance signatures. The first occurs when the variance of a program's metrics collapses to absolute zero.
Okay, looking at the spinning top, as the top slows down, the wobble gets tighter and tighter. The variance is shrinking.
Right.
Eventually, the wobble hits absolute zero and the top falls over. It stops. It halts. The state distribution collapses to a single point.
That is a perfect visualization. Now, consider the second signature. What if you observe the variance and instead of collapsing to zero, it stabilizes at a positive constant number?
So the top is spinning and it has a wide wobble, but that wobble never changes.
Exactly.
It just keeps spinning in a perfectly consistent, repeating stationary circle forever. It never tightens up, but it never flies out of control.
In software terms, that means the program is non-halting but stationary. It is caught in a deterministic infinite loop.
So it is running forever, but its memory usage and CPU cycles are caught in a totally predictable, unchanging cycle.
Right. And the third signature, what if the variance explodes?
That would be divergent non-halting.
Exactly. The metric variance grows exponentially without bound. A memory leak that consumes the entire server or a loop counter that overloads the system.
The top's wobble gets wilder and wilder. The circle gets wider and wider until it just violently flies off the table. The variance diverges to infinity.
Yes.
But I have to ask the obvious question here. If we can just watch the variance collapse to zero to know it halts, did this framework just disprove Alan Turing? Did we just solve the impossible?
We did not disprove Turing, and understanding why is really vital here. Turing's 1930s proof assumes a theoretical universe.
A theoretical universe.
It assumes infinite memory, infinite time, and perfect logical precision. In that infinite theoretical space, the problem remains mathematically undecidable.
Okay.
But this new central limit theorem method does not operate in a theoretical universe. It operates in the real world.
The real world of physical laptops, cloud servers, thermal throttling, and real hardware constraints.
Right. In the physical world, you have finite resources. You can establish a time limit and a statistical confidence level.
So it's practical.
Very. This framework turns a logical impossibility into a statistical limit detection. You aren't proving with absolute infinite logical certainty what a program will do in a million years.
You are mathematically observing that its physical variance is geometrically collapsing right now.
Which gives you a statistical guarantee of its behavior. It solves the engineering version of the halting problem, not the theoretical one.
Man, we started this deep dive looking at an AI tool for debugging code, and we ended up navigating a statistical physics framework that redefines the limits of computation.
It's quite a journey.
Let's bring this all together for you, the listener. We started with the question injection protocol. The realization that if you want to solve a massive, complex problem, you cannot waste energy searching for one overarching answer. You have to inject entropy.
Generate 32 highly specific targeted questions.
And by distributing those GPS targeted questions, you force collaboration. You look at the stationary foundation, the chaotic execution, and the future decay.
This triggers conditional collapses, where the answer to one hyper-specific question automatically changes the context of another.
Collapsing the ambiguity of the entire system like numbers filling in on a Sudoku board until you reach question 32, which hunts down the highest remaining area of uncertainty and kicks off the loop all over again.
Right.
And then we discovered that this exact same geometry, this mathematical collapse of uncertainty, can literally measure the physical metrics of a running program to statistically guarantee if it will ever stop running.
What is most crucial for the listener to take away is the system agnostic nature of this entire process.
Oh, absolutely.
You do not need a swarm of AI coders to utilize this geometry. You can apply this injection of entropy to your own organizational bottlenecks, your business strategies, or your personal decision making.
Yeah.
When facing a wall of ambiguity, ambiguity, stop exhausting your compute energy looking for the answer. Generate 32 highly specific questions, map the structure, map the chaotic variables, and let the answers organically collapse your search space.
Because questions truly are cheaper than answers. And actually, there is one final incredibly provocative thought buried deep in the source material that we have to leave you to mull over.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
It connects this entire framework to something in physics called Landauer's limit.
Rolf Landauer's principle regarding the thermodynamics of computation.
Right. Landauer proved that erasing physical information like wiping data off a hard drive is not just some abstract software event. It actually costs physical heat and physical energy in the real world.
There is an inescapable thermodynamic cost to erasing information.
Well, if this central limit theorem framework proves that a software program halting is mathematically defined as the geometric collapse of uncertainty.
And if physics tells us that erasing uncertainty costs physical energy.
Does that mean the invisible software code running inside our laptops is bound by the exact same thermodynamic laws as the physical universe?
The connection to your spinning top analogy becomes literal at that point. Code is not just an abstract thought floating in the ether. It is manipulating physical voltages.
Logic is geometry. And when that top finally stops spinning and the variance officially collapses to absolute zero, it releases actual measurable physical heat into the universe. Keep that in mind the next time your computer fans suddenly spin up.